We're back with Backstory. Peter Romanoff is my name, and the 18th century is my game.
My game? It's the 19th century. I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow, historian of all things 20th century. Today on Backstory, we're talking about our favorite kind of time, time off. And we're asking why Americans work so hard at play. Was it always like this?
We've got another phone call. It's John in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, I was wondering if you can make some sort of a distinction between, you know, sort of men's leisure and women's leisure. It seems that in the sort of traditional view, at least of American life, the stereotype view from, I don't know, the 1950s or from television shows or something, women seem to have to always be at work. Now, I think both inside and outside the house, you know, certainly expected to be doing housework, you know, probably unfairly, but that may still be a stereotype in our culture. I'm wondering if there have been any movements for women to sort of reclaim leisure in the same way that, you know, the 40-hour work week has happened sort of more generally.
You know, women becoming couch potatoes?
Well, maybe not becoming couch potatoes, but being able to, you know, when they come home from work, not having to necessarily be expected to do all the cooking and cleaning, and how that sort of fits in with the more general ideas of leisure.
Yeah, well, John, let's start with the women who were not at work, which by definition was middle class and in many instances upper middle class. Mm-hmm. Throughout the 20th century, those women were always being told that they were going to get a lot more leisure time because they were going to get all these work-saving devices, starting with the washing machine, the vacuum cleaner. And, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to the leisure dome, which is the standards for cleanliness in houses somehow kept getting more and more exacting. So these women found themselves in an odd kind of way, working harder and harder, even though they had all of these work-saving devices.
In the big fad that I think is the watershed in women having physical activity for fun is the bicycle. In the late 19th century, and you know, we think about you know, Daisy, and you know, bicycle built for two, and all that. That's because that was really the first mass adoption of physical activity for women who had some time. And of course, it was a topic of great worry among ministers and others. Women riding the bicycles, and also the other things that went along with it, roller skates, swimming in the ocean. It seemed to be a complete violation of standards of ladies' decorum, and also they thought it was dangerous to their health and their physique and all this sort of stuff. So the answer to the question is in the late 19th century is when you first start seeing activity that we would think of as precursors to today's physical activity that is shared by men and women, but perhaps with a different spin by gender.
It's a long way from there to Title IX, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the other thing that your discussion sort of brings up is, you know, Title IX has obviously made great strides for women in, I don't know, the last 30 or 40 years since it was adopted. But it also leads me to think that with sporting activities sort of trickling down to the high school level, I know that I just finished going to college just a couple of years ago, and I'm remembering the application process and how stressful that was and how there's sort of a lot of pressure on people to get accepted into colleges. And one of the things that people are doing to try to pad their resumes and pad their applications are these sports, these things that I would like to think of as leisure, but I'm not so sure if they're leisure anymore.
Well, that's the terrific question, and have we turned play into more work? Certainly, I grew up, you know, going down to the basketball court, getting a pickup basketball game, playing two-on-two. When I raised my kids, you know, it was all very organized, three practices a week. You had to get the uniforms. You were sure to get a trophy no matter how poorly your team did. And it just
became... I never got a trophy.
Yeah, well, your team did particularly poorly.
I certainly never got any trophy.
Anyway, it all got very organized and it got very stressful. And, you know, we were talking about the connection between work and play before. But what I realized, my seventh year of coaching Little League is that, you know, for a lot of the kids in these Little Leagues, or I should say for a lot of the dads, they had, in their mind at least, a college scholarship, riding on little Johnny starting at shortstop, being the all-star, being picked, and that's worth a lot of money, and that got very quickly into the world of work.
John,
than play.
That's why we do backstory. We're desperately looking for the next fun activity, and it's because we're so relaxed here, and nobody's winning, I think.
Anyway, yeah, this is leisure for you guys.
Sadly,
actually,
it is.
John, thank you for your call.
All right, thank you very
Thanks,
much,
John.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Well, there's no rest for the weary, guys, because we got another phone call. This one's from David in Niles, Michigan.
David, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
What you got on your mind today?
I was thinking in terms of Gordon Wood's book, The Radicalism of the American Revolution.
Yeah.
And in it, in his whole social hierarchy, mm-hmm. He talks about gentlemen and that they didn't work and it was a good thing.
Yeah, the clean hands people.
Right. They were the leisure.
Insurance company?
Yeah. The leisured class. And it was almost contemptible for them to.
Yeah.
Hold on, guys. Could you tell me who this Gordon Wood character
is?
Well,
he's a prominent historian, now retired, who taught at Brown University and is the author of a couple of major books that have rocked the history field. And David's telling us about radicalism, which has got some nice stuff about the development of culture and politics during the revolutionary period, and we're talking about what it means to be a gentleman.
It almost seems work was for the common people,
and
it was almost a rude form, but by the time Wood gets to the democratization of society, work becomes this glorious thing that people are... pleased about, and then they're scorning anybody that doesn't want to work.
Mm.
And I'm just wondering, my question is, how does the whole idea of the Puritan work ethic, and how does that fit into that?
Mm-hmm.
It seems so big today. Should we be calling it the democratized work ethic?
Yeah.
I mean, because Wood almost suggests that this is where work became good.
Right. Even though there is this notion of gentility in which you don't work with your hands, it's a culture that celebrates work in a broader sense. Nobody lived off of rents or income in colonial America, with a very, very few exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
There simply wasn't that much surplus wealth and unearned wealth from rents and from lending money out that would enable people to be a true leisure class. Big, big difference between Britain and America at this time, and it's an enormous difference in the concentration of wealth, and just look at the size of houses. The big houses of colonial America are pathetic cottages compared to Blenheim Palace and other big houses in Britain. But even those people who aspire to gentility valued work, and at the same time that we have a notion you shouldn't work with your hands, there's the cult of the artisan. Think of some of the most important people of the revolutionary period, people like Ben Franklin, the great printer, and there was nothing disgraceful about his career as a printer that is a working man. So David's question suggests that democratization puts a new value on work, and what I would say is that democratization means that enterprise is universalized. In fact, more people have more opportunity to work in ways that benefit themselves. Now, I'm talking about free white men, but within that fairly large category, people are working like crazy. And Tocqueville came to America and he observed this. It's just an incredibly busy place.
Yeah, so the paradox is you actually find less leisure as people become better off.
Yeah, and that's a paradox we're living with today, isn't it?
Yeah.
David, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
It was a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, at the start of today's show, Cindy Aaron told us that as much as we might fantasize about time off from work, we Americans are a people that are really terrified of idleness. And so we go to great lengths to structure our leisure time in ways that allow us to feel productive, even when we're not exactly producing anything.
Well, a couple of years back, a creative writing professor out at the University of California in Riverside decided to face up to the terror and stare idleness in the face. The result was a book called Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. Its author is Tom Lutz. Brian and I sat down recently with Tom and asked him what inspired him to take on the history of sloth.
Well, it began when my son, at the age of 18, moved into my house and proceeded to lie on the couch day in, day out, watching TV. And in fact, you know, he was only on my couch for a couple of weeks total. It just, as a historian of emotion, I became very interested in the fact that I was so angry at him for lying
about
when...
Yeah, so it was a voyage of self-discovery for you, huh, Tom, figuring out why you were so upset with your son?
I wanted to know why I was so pissed off, yeah. And as I did the research, I realized that this happens all the time. People are angry at people in America, at people who don't work. It's a very, very common reaction.
Tom, I wonder if you could help us define slacking. I mean, how do you distinguish it from leisure, from play, from rest?
In some ways, obviously, there is no difference. If you're a Martian scientist, come down and look at a slacker, look at the Great Lebowski lying on his couch, and look at a guru meditating, you're not going to see any difference, and one would be considered a slacker and the other would not. But the main difference that I was interested in is when slacking becomes an identity.
Yeah, Tom, it's a pejorative definition, isn't it? People might take that on and call themselves slackers, but it begins with a judgment.
It begins with a judgment, and I think that, you know, for a lot of people, that judgment is part of the ethos, right. And they both own it, kind of throw it back in the face of the people who are offering it to them, and are troubled by it in various ways as well.
Is slacker another word for adolescent?
No. No, not necessarily. There are slackers of all ages. I mean, you know, Samuel Johnson in the 18th century complained to himself about his own sloth and his own slackerdom late into his 60s. It's certainly clear that some of the slacking that we know and see around us is directly the result of people graduating from high school or graduating from college and being in a betwixt and between statuses and wondering what they're going to do next. And also, of course, the midlife crisis, where people drop out of their law profession and get a boat.
So are you getting ready for that now yourself? Or
yeah, I'm actually leaving for a month wandering through Eastern Europe tomorrow.
You planned a month-long midlife crisis?
I'm calling it research, but...
How has slacking changed over the years, or has it? Is it a particularly American thing?
I think that before there's a work ethic, you don't have slackers. And so in the classical world, in the ancient world, there are people who had to work, and there were undoubtedly people who were lazy, but there were no slackers as such. It wasn't an identity. If you were lucky, you didn't have to work. If you were unlucky, you did. The first wave of slacker literature, it comes right with the Industrial Revolution in Britain, and you can kind of chart the rise of a slacker subculture everywhere as the Industrial Revolution hits. So it's a little bit later in the U.S. than it was in Britain. It's roughly the same time, even slightly earlier in Germany. It's much later in India, later in Japan. And then as work changes in fundamental ways, we get an invigoration of slacker culture at each of those moments. So I don't think it's an accident that when everybody looked up and realized they were working in cubicles on computer screens, that's a different kind of work than the work we were trained to think about ourselves doing.
We're really interested in boredom, which must be a central theme for you. When did people start getting bored?
Yeah, my understanding is that it is also an 18th century phenomenon. It is a phenomenon of modernity. The idea that there's something out there that might be better than what's in front of you, I think is essential to boredom. And it may also be essential to slacking. That is, why would you go to your job, you know, as a barista at Starbucks if what you really should be doing is writing your symphony?
Yeah.
Why, you know, right. the idea that there's something over the horizon which is awaiting you.
Does our society need slackers, Tom? I mean, if we didn't have slackers, would we have to invent them?
Yeah, I think that in a culture in which the work ethic is this strong, you need people representing the other side of things. You need people to represent kind of kissing off all of that.
Yeah, and so they make a judgment in return on us.
Yeah,
exactly. The really people with the strongest work ethic and the people with the weakest work ethic provide the kind of poles through which we all, you know, negotiate our own relation to these issues
and tell ourselves we're normal.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the questions is: Are we so infected with our own work ethic that we can't just relax? And I have to admit that I'm one of those people. I'm hitting about 13 countries in this month.
Oh, that changes my image totally. 13 countries.
Yeah, you said
that's
you were
going
to go slack.
Yeah, well, I like to slack at a very, very fast pace.
You said that's hyper-slacking. Is that the technical term?
Maybe.
Tom, it's been great talking with you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
My pleasure.
Tom Lutz is a professor of creative writing at University of California, Riverside. He's the author of Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America.
That's a great interview, guys. You know, I buy into the fundamental principle of backstory, which is that everything has a history. But I have to admit, it never occurred to me that slacking was located in time, that there was a history of goofing off.
Hey, how about slack story?
Oh.
All right. Oh, you don't have to do anything, man. Just kick back and enjoy the show.
Well, I don't know. You know, there is a history of slacking, but what was most interesting to me about what Lutz was saying is that slacking at some point becomes almost an identity. It's this kind of radical challenge to what we just really take for granted, what we just assume, which is work is right, work is good, work is ethical, you know, and it's true. There's, you know, you guys remember all those slacker movies, Big Lebowski, Reality Bites. I mean, these are people who are devoted to the notion of doing nothing.
Well, Brian, I do think there's a life cycle dimension to it. That is, I think our students as undergraduates now, and I hope they're none listening right now, are
pretty safe bet.
Turn off your radios and iPods.
You know, I have a theory about this. They're going to go into professional and business lives in which they work all the time. And I think they're taking a vacation before they go. So I think slackerdom is a phase.
So it's hibernation. It's like hibernation.
Yeah.
Sorts.
Yeah. Something
That's
like
very
that.
Interesting.
You know, listening to that, I kept thinking about Walt Whitman and Leaves of Grass. I loaf and invite my soul. Or you think about Thoreau and Walden, which is a whole lot of slacking going on.
Yeah.
And, I guess it strikes me that this really begins in the antebellum period in the Northeast, which is as Tom Lutz was saying, until you have sort of really strong work ethic, you can't really have a definition of slackerdom. So it's interesting that in New York City and in Concord, Massachusetts, the first sort of poet laureates of goofing off emerged.
Yeah, you know, it's really dialectical, Ed.
Yeah.
Wow, that's heavy.
Yeah, too heavy for a vacation show, guys, which is why I'm delighted that the moment I've been waiting for has finally arrived, the moment we can take a break and one that...
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner is our engineer.
Gabi Alter wrote our theme music. And Backstory's executive producer is none other than Andrew Windham. Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation, Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein, and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
And Caroline Feeney, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J.M. Weinberg, Dr. Anna McGee, and an anonymous donor.
Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.